morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Excuse me. May it please the court, my name is Carmen Hernandez. I represent Samuel Lopez Sierra Gutierrez. Mr. Lopez Sierra Gutierrez was sentenced to 300 months by Judge Leon after a trial. The charges were conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States. There were 15 defendants originally, only two went to trial. The other defendant's case went to trial with Mr. Lopez Sierra, resulted in a mistrial, and that defendant received a sentence of time served. The lead defendant in this case, who testified pursuant to a cooperation agreement and who admitted to having shipped multi-ton quantities all over the world, including the United States, and making multi-million dollars, received a sentence of around 10 years. Mr. Lopez Sierra was listed on the indictment way down the list, not one of the lead defendants, nonetheless. And one of the issues that I'm raising here is the sentence, but let me not start there. The first question that I'd like to address is the issue of whether the defendant was represented by conflict-free attorney. On the eve of trial, the government filed a pleading saying that the attorney was under investigation for a money laundering offense involving the very defendant at trial. Judge Leon held a hearing. The defendant appointed the public defender to represent the defendant. The defendant waived his right to conflict-free representation. The argument that I make is, one, it was not a waivable conflict.
What do you do about the Sixth Amendment protects not just the right to conflict-free counsel, but the right to counsel of your choice, correct?
Yes, sir.
So how do you, don't we always have to balance? I mean, on your argument, you're giving no weight at all to the latter. That is, he does have a Sixth Amendment right to counsel of his choice.
Correct, but that choice, that Sixth Amendment right, is not absolute. The court also has.
I didn't say. I said there's two rights. You have a right to. Do you agree with me, by the way, that the Sixth Amendment protects both rights?
Yes, sir.
Correct, the right to counsel, to conflict-free counsel, and the right to counsel of their choice.
Yes.
And what I read the district court trying to do here is to balance those. The
problem in this case is that by the time this issue arises, literally on the eve of trial, the defendant had been incarcerated for, 42 months. Mm-hmm. 32 of those months here. And he clearly said when he waived his right to conflict-free counsel, he really said, look, I've been sitting here for 42 months. I've been working on this case with this attorney for 3 years. I don't want to start all over.
He wanted the attorney he had for 3 years. And this brings us to the question, the balance between conflict and choice, that what more could the judge have done to make this balance than Judge Leon did in this case?
Well,
I mean look, let me ask you the question. That Gonzalez-Lopez case that you cited, that's the one where the judge made the other ruling.
Well,
you cite it as if it somehow supports you in this case, but the judge below came out the other way and got reversed on that one.
There's so many problems with this issue. First, the government waits until the eve of trial, and, you know, I believe we also argued there's a speedy trial violation to begin with. So to have somebody sit in jail for 42 months, and this is an extradition case. A year of that 42 months, or almost a year, was sitting in Colombia waiting to be extradited. The government sits in these cases.
Was he resisting extradition?
No, but the process in Colombia is such that
You're moving now to your other argument. Let's stick with the conflict argument.
Yeah, what more could the judge have done balance the two parts of that Sixth Amendment right?
I mean, let me just follow up on the Chief Judge's question, because, you know, when you look at this transcript here, first of all, he appointed independent counsel to represent the defendant on this issue.
Correct.
And then, you know, you read the transcript here and you see Judge Leon very carefully questioning him and raising the key. Do you understand, he asks, that since he's been named in as a possible suspect in a criminal investigation, that he might be in some way tempted to take actions that might not be in the client's benefit in order to assist himself. And he asks him that question three or four times. He's represented by independent counsel, conflict counsel, and he very clearly says yes. In fact, Judge Leon, you know, makes sure that he answers yes, that he doesn't. Tell me what's wrong with that.
Well, number one, as I said, I think the time that's hanging over his head, which is clearly expressed by the defendant as part of the reason why he doesn't want to give up this counsel, is an issue. Secondly, I think the government bears some responsibility because what Judge Leon said to the government is give up that witness that may create the I mean, there were two conflicts. The conflict is that the attorney is laboring under the potential that he might be prosecuted. There's an investigation under him, and so he may be willing to kowtow to the government or pull back, pull his punches. And the second question was that there was a witness that might raise this issue. And the government left that hanging over the case until either the last witness or until the last day of trial. So that supposedly the conflict was vivid the entire trial. The government could have said, as Judge Leon said, pull that witness. This is a long trial. You don't need that witness. Pull that witness so that particular issue is not. The government refused to pull the witness and kept it up until the last minute and then said we're not going to call him. But, Your Honor, it was a difficult issue.
Sure
I agree.
Right. Judge Leon. And the district court really struggled with it.
He did.
Yeah.
But I would ask the court to just see that the defendant's waiver was not totally voluntary because it is layered by the fact that he's sitting in jail for 42 months and is facing the proposition that if he gets a new counsel, he may need to sit in jail for another two or three years.
What in its brief, the government invokes judicial estoppel. You know, the defendant's taken a completely different position here than he did in the district court, and you didn't file a reply brief. So what's your answer to that?
Well, I my answer is that the waiver was
no. I'm asking you about the government's judicial estoppel argument.
That because the defendant took a different position, and I'm saying the position taken by the defendant was colored by his concerns about sitting in jail for another 3 years. So it's not. I'm saying that the position he took in the district court was not a fully knowing and voluntary because of the pressure on him to not sit in jail. That's what I'm saying, and that's why it shouldn't bar review. The position I think is, however this court reads it, there's no question the defendant is concerned about having to sit in jail for another 42 months until the next counsel comes up to speed, which is considerable. This is a defendant who's sitting in a foreign country, in a jail in a foreign country, has no visitors or anything of that kind. D.C. jail is not the friendliest location. I can tell the court that I have defendants sitting in maximum security in federal prisons who tell me maximum security prisons are better than the D.C. jail. So that's my response to that, Your Honor. It was not a knowing and voluntary position, and he should not be stopped because of the burden of having to sit in pretrial detention. I don't want to give up the other issues, although I'm happy to answer any questions the court has on this particular issue. The speedy trial issue, again, segueing into it, I mean, this guy sat in jail for 959 days before the case went to trial. And yes, there were 15 defendants, but only two went to trial, him and the other guy. And everybody else pled guilty. So although it sounds like a complex case, 15 defendants, in fact, we're talking about two defendants. These cases from Colombia, and I've done several of them, are complex and not complex. They're just a drug case.
Your whole argument turns on these two orders, correct? I mean, I hear your point about all the days, but your argument focuses on these two orders, right? The missing order and the later order.
Yes, sir.
Correct?
Yes.
And so is it your position that first, the missing order was never entered?
It was never entered. There's no record that it was ever entered.
It was never issued? That the court never issued the order?
I don't know.
Well, what do you do about
The fact that Mr. La Pasiera had apparently an incompetent counsel who conceded there was an order that hadn't been entered.
That's an ineffective.
That'll be all
conflicting.
I mean, that's a different. That's a separate argument. You know, that you'll raise that later, I assume, right? But that's not before us now. Right now, we have this concession. Quote, this order does not appear on the docket sheet, but defendant accepts the fact that it was signed. Right?
Maybe he wasn't an incompetent lawyer. Maybe he's an honest lawyer.
Or perhaps he was a conflicted lawyer along.
In fact, I'll tell you what's really weird about this thing. He seems to me to be quoting from the order. Right? Aren't these quotations from the actual order? Where are they from?
I don't know what they're from. They're not in the record.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah, I agree it's not in the record, but he looks like he's quoting from the order. So
I don't know.
So, okay, so what do we do? We've got this concession, ineffective assistance of counsel you'll raise later. What do we do with this?
What's
left for you on this point?
I don't know what the answer is. There is no order. I can't make it up. I accept that they both refer to an order, but there's no findings with respect to the order. But even
the second order refers to the first order, too.
Right. But the second order...
All the evidence before us, including the concession in the district court, suggests that there is an order and there was some sort of clerical error that didn't end up in the docket. So,
all I can say is when I represent clients, if there's a clerical error, somehow it never comes out nicely for me.
Right.
So I would ask the court to...
Yeah, some of us have the same problem.
So there's this, even if we all concede the order was lost somewhere, the second order is equally bad. Ends of justice. At that point in time, two or three, it's in November of 2005, the defendant has been sitting in jail for a long time. The record is a mess. The court in its formal order says all the pretty things, but there's no question that during the hearing, he's saying, my docket is congested, I have all these cases coming up, I can't do it, blah, blah, blah. The other thing is that the other defendant,
what do you want us to say about that? We've got an order.
You can't.
Where the judge articulates the proper reasons. He articulates the balance. What do we say about that? Do we say he wasn't telling the truth?
You cannot have a defendant sit in jail for 959 days to bring him to trial. That's what I want you to say.
We can't say that.
You can't?
You can't say that. There are all kinds of exclusions in the law, and we can't make a blanket statement that says there's no exclusion.
And you don't even challenge all of them. You don't even challenge all of them.
I have 2 minutes left, but I'll answer the court's... The burden is on the government, and the burden is on the government. You cannot have someone sit in jail for 959 days unless you meet certain requirements.
Now you're getting more acceptable when you say unless you meet certain requirements.
Both constitutionally and under the statute. I don't believe the government met its burden here. And frankly, I'm not going to fault Judge Leon. It was the government's obligation to make sure that the findings were made correctly. And the second defendant, part of the delay in this case is due to the second defendant who's sitting in jail unrepresented because his first counsel, retained counsel, was allowed to withdraw without a replacement counsel to represent another defendant in the same case. Crazy case, I admit, Your Honor. And just to be clear, I represented the second defendant court-appointed at trial, and we hung the jury. So it was not a case that was a slam dunk.
You wanted to mention the sentence issue. Can you?
Yeah, the sentence issue. This is a big deal. I'm pushing this.
Add on a couple of minutes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll let you go over. Fine.
Thank you. The multiple conspiracy issue is a big deal, also, Your Honor. But I'll go to the sentencing because you asked. There's a conflict in the circuits. The Fourth Circuit, which originally went down this track under Judge Wilkins, who was a sentencing expert and chair of the Sentencing Commission. The Fourth Circuit requires very properly, I believe, that a jury be instructed on any conspiracy that in order to find the particular defendant guilty of a particular quantity, or guilty of the conspiracy, that it be required to make the finding on the quantity reasonably foreseeable as, and within the scope of the defendant's conspiracy, rather than don't bother yourself with the quantity of drugs attributable to the particular defendant and just worry about the conspiracy. Well, that, particularly post-Apprendi, creates an awful situation for a defendant. He's charged in a huge conspiracy. No question it's more than 5 kilos. His participation is minor, relatively speaking, for purposes of quantity. In the olden days, it didn't matter because the judge got to make those findings particularized within the scope of his agreement. But now, he just...
Well, in the real olden days, we didn't even have to do that exactly.
Correct, but we don't want to go back that far.
Okay.
But right now, the Fourth Circuit is very clear. If you don't ask the jury on those two points in a conspiracy, you cannot sentence that defendant to the mandatory minimum and to the maximum under the enhanced penalties. The D.C. Circuit has been sort of wishy-washy on it. In U.S. I apologize for
being... okay.
I'm in the middle...
Sometimes we are.
Fair.
It's okay.
Let me explain. I'm literally in the middle of trial. I have the morning off, so my presentation may be a little more trial than appellate. But
fair enough, too. Go ahead.
But in law, this court said, added this language of the quantity of drugs the jury attributes to him as a reasonably foreseeable part of the conspiracy was the requirement. But this court has never required the district courts to tell the jury, before you make a finding on a drug conspiracy as to a particular defendant, you know, whether he's guilty of the 5 kilo for cocaine, for example. 5 kilos gets him 10 to life. 500 grams gets him 5 to 40. Less than that gets him up to 20. Since Apprendi, this court has never required the district court to instruct the jury that in order to make those quantity findings, it has to make a finding reasonably foreseeable and within the scope of the particular defendant's conspiracy. And so you have a lot of injustices, I would argue, since Apprendi. Good on one end, and on the end, terrible. The Fourth Circuit has been great, has been real clear, and it frankly, once you're real clear, there's no problem. The juries give, the judges give the instruction. The juries are able to make those findings. Fourth Circuit, there's no question, they still continue to find defendants guilty of the greatest conspiracy in a given case, and in another case they don't. And I just ask the court to require the district courts.
What do you think about the government's argument that if there was an error here, it was harmless because of the vast amount of drugs involved?
As I say, this was a long trial. The jury was out for a long time, sent several questions out to the.
No, but that's not a response to the government's harmless error argument.
It wasn't. The point is that it wasn't. There was only one particular. There was a lot of talk about a lot of drugs, but as to this defendant, again, and this gets us back to the multiple conspiracies.
He was involved in the Puerto Rican thing, right? I mean, that's the allegation.
Well, that appears to be. Yeah. I'm not sure what the jury found.
The government says in its brief there were, you know, the amount of drugs involved was 92 times the 5 kilograms.
It was not a clear. The defendant, Mr. Lopez Sierra's argument was that his deal was to ship drugs to Venezuela, period. It ended there. And what happens thereafter was not.
That's not responsive to the question, because the jury obviously found Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Well, we have to read it that way, at least. Or we
don't know what the jury found, but they obviously
The jury must have found that he intended to import it. That was that's what he's convicted on. So we have to assume, for purposes of this argument, that he was involved in the drugs that went to Puerto Rico, and the government says, look, you know, even if there was a mistake,
but
it was like 100 times, almost 100 times the amount of drugs were attributable to that.
There were multiple transactions.
Mm-hmm.
The Puerto Rico transaction was one transaction. The Puerto Rico transaction was hotly contested, and in fact, with respect to the defendant I represented at trial, as to whom there was a hung jury, mostly in favor of acquittal, they had tried to implicate him in the Puerto Rico transaction. So it's not, what I'm saying is that it's not clear that the jury ended up finding the Puerto Rico transaction the salient transaction, because there were a lot of challenges to the testimony on the Puerto Rico transaction. There were other transactions that they might have found involved, because Mr. Lopez Sierra's argument was twofold. One of them was that he was really shipping to Venezuela, nothing else, and he was also involved in some money laundering, which was unrelated, which gets me back, I know I'm way beyond, which gets me back to the issue of multiple conspiracies. Everyone admitted that there were multiple conspiracies. Why the instruction was not given is not clear from the record. It should have been given. The jury should have had to decide whether there was multiple conspiracies. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government. Will you be back in a couple of minutes?
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Vijay Shankar with the Department of Justice. Your Honors, if I could, I'd like to start with the last issue, the sentencing issue. I think I can make a couple quick points on that before we move on to the other ones. Again, this issue is reviewed for plain error, not just harmless error here. This issue was not preserved by Mr. Lopez Sierra in the trial court. Now, as Judge Tatel pointed out, the Puerto Rico transaction alone involved 462 kilograms. My colleague says there's no way to know whether the jury relied on that transaction and there were other transactions. Well, the evidence at trial showed four specific transactions, and each one of them involved three-digit quantities of cocaine. So whichever one the jury relied on, we have multiple times the minimum quantity to reach
there's
the
statutory no minimum. Scenario under which they could find him guilty of a smaller quantity.
Exactly, Your Honor. So unless the court has any further questions about sentencing, I'd like to address the conflict issue.
What about the multiple conspiracy point? Do you want to just say something about that?
Certainly, Your Honor. Again, the evidence here reviewed by this court de novo does show the existence of a single conspiracy involving...
Could it have also shown multiple conspiracies? We've got to look at this back at the stage of the instruction.
Correct.
We're not just looking at what the record would support at that point. We have to see what.
Well, the decision whether to give the instruction was made after the close of evidence. Mm-hmm.
Could the evidence at that point have supported multiple conspiracies?
I think not, Your Honor. I think it more reasonably supports multiple overt acts in support of a single conspiracy involving the same large group of players to import cocaine into the United States. Again, there was evidence that Mr. Padilla, the co-defendant, and Mr. Lopez Sierra conversed about the Puerto Rico transaction, so they were both involved in that. That, again, is a single act in this conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States. The evidence shows that Mr. Padilla and Mr. Lopez Sierra were both connected to the leaders of this conspiracy, Mr. Osorio and Mr. Tobón. They were both connected to Mr. Fakih, who was sort of the facilitator of all of these transactions. There were drugs found in Mr. Padilla's house that were connected to the Osorio conspiracy. They had the same stamps and stickers on them. So again, this is a single conspiracy. It involves multiple players. A lot of the acts involved certain players and not others, but that's very common in conspiracy cases, and this court and others have held that the fact that certain conspirators are involved in certain acts and other conspirators are involved in other acts does not necessarily indicate that there are multiple conspiracies. Turning to the conflict point, my colleague mentioned that the government waited until the eve of trial to mention this issue. Well, the government didn't learn about this until the eve of trial. When preparing this government witness for testimony, that's when the government witness mentioned this issue. So this wasn't an issue of delay by the government. My colleague also mentioned that during the waiver, Mr. Lopez Sierra mentioned that he was most concerned about the amount of time that had passed. I respectfully take issue with that. He did mention that he had been with this counsel for 3.5 years, and he did want trial to proceed, but he said multiple times and quite clearly and adamantly that he was, quote-unquote, 100% satisfied with counsel and wanted to stick with him. It's also important to remember that the government and the defense had come to an understanding that if this witness were to testify, he could do so without mentioning counsel's name. So I think that really alleviated any of the concerns here. And I also think that this court need not close its eyes to the fact that this witness, in fact, did not testify. Now, obviously, that wasn't known to the district court at the time that Judge Leon had to make the decisions here, but it does inform this court's analysis as to whether this trial really was fair and whether Mr. Lopez-Sierra had to proceed with conflicted counsel or whether the conflict was, in fact, alleviated, if not eliminated, by the fact that this witness was never called by the government. And again, all of this has to be considered within the broader context of the fact that whether you call it judicial estoppel or whether you simply consider the larger equities here, Mr. Lopez-Sierra did adamantly insist to the district court that this was a waivable conflict, and the government itself raised the prospect that it was concerned about obtaining a conviction and having it be challenged on appeal. And that was exactly the government's concern. And in fact, the district court, Judge Leon himself mentioned to Mr. Lopez-Sierra, what I would like to avoid is you telling me that this is waivable and then raising this on appeal later. Can we do that? And everybody agreed that we could do that. And so it would really be unfair under the circumstances of this case to find that this conflict was not waivable. Turning briefly to the speedy trial issue, Judge Tatel was correct that everything turns on these two ends of justice continuances. And so the real issue is whether there, in fact, was a first order. And again, I think it was discussed in my colleague's time that there really can be little question, given all of the evidence before us, that there was a first order. Mr. Lopez-Sierra acknowledged in his opposition.
No, it's very odd, right? I mean, okay, so maybe it's not in the record, but orders are served on all the parties. No one has what? Isn't that strange?
Your Honor, it's
I assume
strange.
The government's looked through its files. You don't have it either?
The government did look through its files. The government doesn't have it, of course.
I mean, how could an order just vanish from all of the places it's supposed to be? I could understand, you know, how a clerk might. I mean, I can't remember. This was before we had electronic filings, wasn't it?
My understanding is that this was actually at just about the exact time that the district court was switching over to electronic filings.
I mean, so maybe it not only didn't get entered, but didn't get served? But then wouldn't somebody have noticed that?
That's speculation, Your Honor. Now, again, at this time, we were really dealing with 15 defendants still. I know that many of
them. I'm not asking you that. I realize that. But, I mean, how can it not be anywhere if it was, right? I mean,
Your Honor, I'm sorry. All I can say is that I don't know, and I can't speculate as to that. And I'm not falling back on the point that I wasn't trial counsel, but this
I understand. No, we understand
ago.
That.
We don't like you to fall back on
yeah.
that.
Yes, we got that.
And again, I'm not, but that's only to say that I really have no way of reconstructing what happened at the time. But
what do we do? We just rely on the apparent concession and on the district court's May, 26 order?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And I think Mr. Lopez-Sierra, again, as Judge Tatel, you yourself said, Mr. Lopez-Sierra quoted from the order.
Well, we don't know. I mean, there are quotation marks, but we don't have the order, so we don't know what he was quoting from.
That may be, but he did concede that it was signed and issued. And the district court, Judge Leon himself said, I issued this order. And so this court would have to disbelieve in a pejorative sense, but not take on face value what the district court said and also disregard Mr. Lopez-Sierra's own concession.
I want to ask you something that perhaps is beyond the scope of this case, and perhaps I shouldn't ask you, and I'm going to anyway. You say in your brief, page 12, the 3.5-year delay in this significant international drug trafficking case was not uncommonly long. Is it not a bit disturbing that in a country that has a constitutional provision for speedy trial and a statute for speedy trial, that is the government not at all disturbed that that statement can be made?
Well, Your Honor, it's certainly a long period of time.
Yeah.
I don't deny that. It is shorter than a lot of other constitutional speedy trial cases, the ones that we cited in our brief. Doggett involved an 8.5-year delay,
yeah.
Barker a 5, Chibasa was an 11-year delay. That's this court's own case. these cases, it's unfortunately a long period of time, but I think the period of time has to be considered within the context of the larger case and the reasons. Again, that's why Barker sets forth a four-pronged standard. What are the reasons for the delay? Were they understandable? Were they the result of the government not prosecuting the case with vigorously or purposely delaying? And none of that was shown here, Your Honor. And if the court has no further questions, government will rest on its brief.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel. We'll give the appellant back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If you need.
On the speedy trial issue, not only is it on those two motions, the government excludes time two times for filing of motions. Those two motions are one, again, crazy counsel below files an interlocutory appeal to this court. I apologize.
That's okay. I mean, you're going to have a great 2255 motion, it sounds like.
He filed an interlocutory appeal to this court on the speedy trial issue. Clearly not an issue that's subject to interlocutory appeal, so the government excludes. The Speedy Trial Act doesn't require automatic or doesn't permit automatic exclusion for every motion.
No, but for interlocutory appeal, it permits.
The case did not stop.
Okay.
It continued below. And the second motion that where they're adapting this automatic exclusion is because he filed a motion for release since he had been in prison for so long and he wanted to be released pretrial. Neither of the motions required hearings or neither of the motions, in fact, delayed the proceedings. With respect to the multiple conspiracies, there's a section. I mean, Judge Leon, in the middle of trial, he says, so if it's a question of fact, and I cited at page 32 of the brief, the court, the fact of the matter is that there is a tape, it's a tape recorded conversation that has been transcribed and translated as well where Mr., and then the judge says, again, it's up to the jury to decide what to believe. Defense counsel, but just for the record, I need to say if it's a question of fact, then it's a jury question, and we're talking about multiple conspiracies. And Judge Leon says, I understand that. And for some reason, at the end of the trial, it would have required a simple instruction. And this idea.
Not a simple instruction.
This idea, it's not as difficult as others.
Okay.
This idea that just because you're a drug trafficker in Colombia, you've got one conspiracy doesn't meet the standards that this court imposes. You have to have some interdependence. And the question of whether there was interdependence among the multiple groupings in this case was a fact-bound question that should have been put to the jury.
You're actually over your time. But
yes, sir. I do hope you resolve the sentencing issue.
Now, I am correct that you're appointed in this case.
I am, sir.
And the court wants to thank you for your representation of the appellant and your service to the court and the United States.
Thank you, Judge. Counsel. Thanks.